Hey, this is Aaron Carnes. We started this podcast in 2021 to promote my book, In Defense of Ska. Since then, the podcast has grown into its own thing. I've been working on an expanded second edition. I interviewed new people, edited every chapter, and there's a new final chapter, 30,000 new words. The expanded second edition of In Defense of Ska will be released on October 29th, 2024. Can you do something for me? Pre-order it right now at clashbooks.com under the Books tab. The more copies it sells in advance, the more it'll get people to support ska music. Thanks. Tour life is hard, and if you're a DIY band, sometimes roadie options amount to who's ever willing to drive. In the film Uncle Peckerhead, punk rock trio Duh reluctantly agree to bring an old guy named Peckerhead as their roadie because he owns a van. Turns out he also eats people. Uncle Peckerhead is a punk rock horror comedy film that showcases the DIY tour life in a surprisingly realistic way, aside from the people-eating part. It's a great film that even has an entire scene built around a slapstick song title. We sat down with filmmaker Matthew John Lawrence and star Jeff Riddle, who also happened to write all the music for the film.
I was the one that told you about the movie Uncle Peckerhead, right?
You did, yes.
I had had it told me by my wife's uncle. It was like, you need to watch this movie, Uncle Peckerhead. And I was like, what? That name's terrible. And I was like really resistant to watching it. And then we put it on and it's so good.
Oh yeah. It's an amazing movie.
I feel like more than any other movie, it captures what it feels like to be in a punk band on tour.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've said this before, but I'll say it. I'll be the one to say it here. Is the band actually sounds like a real band, which is super rare in movies, and they're actually a good band.
Right. That was really the turning point. The part that really made me sit up watching the movie was when the band actually started to play, I was like, wait, this sounds like a real band.
Yeah.
And it turns out that Jeff is actually in a real band. He's in 500 bucks. And all the gear in the movie, the van that's in the movie, the house, it's all his actual punk rock like life in that movie.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Movies and stories are always better when like there's like a real piece of the creators in it. And I think that's one of the things about this movie that stands out.
Absolutely.
I would love to just get a real brief explanation of what this movie is and what the movie is about.
Sure. Well, Uncle Peckerhead is an indie horror comedy about a three-piece punk band that goes on the road on their first tour, and it just so happens that their roadie is a man-eating monster.
Mm.
So it's basically the trials and tribulations of a first-time touring band and the all the bullshit they encounter with their lovable monster roadie.
Right off the bat, the first thing I drew a similarity to is the movie Green Room. Both are movies about bands on tour, and it turns into a horror film. But the weird thing is as fantastic as Uncle Peckerhead is, as like, you know, roadie turns into a monster. Uncle Peckerhead feels so much more real to the van touring experience than Green Room.
I mean, that means a lot. I know that in my 20s, I was in a band and I toured a bunch. So like a bunch of the moments in the film are from like personal experiences I had on the road. But I like a lot of the energy and just kind of the depiction of the touring lifestyle just came from like my experiences and Jeff's experiences and a bunch of our friends and buddies that have also been in bands and been touring. So it's just writing what you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. The punk rock, you know, touring DIY lifestyle is something that seems to be very rarely ever captured in a realistic way in a movie or a book or any of these things. So I appreciate that too, the way that you captured it in a way that actually feels like, I was in a band and yeah, it's like this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do, like from the start, when I started writing the script, was I felt that a lot of films, not just Hollywood films, but even indie films, kind of if they do depict the touring lifestyle, it's it's really romanticized. And while like I miss playing in bands and at times I miss being on the road, when I think of the reality of what it was like to be a DIY band on the road with really like no label and no help, you know, we're not like on a tour bus, you know, having these crazy like hotel parties and, you know, getting into hijinks. I mean, we were like sleeping in Walmart parking lots and, you know, eating our shoelaces. I wanted to kind of show the reality of what touring is it can be incredibly fun. You can have these like super high highs when you have a great show or you meet some really awesome people or bands that you run into along the way. But for the most part, I felt that like, I mean, my experience was I was, you know, hungry and kind of like sad and lonely and really worried about like how we're going to make it to the next show in terms of gas and just trying to like stretch every dollar as far as we can. And I had never really seen that in film before.
Yeah. And, you know, even like when Adam mentioned Green Room, like the other extreme is to kind of dramatize it in a weird way.
Yeah.
And like, that's so not what touring is like, you know. It is kind of absurd and there are like kind of these goofy moments. A lot of times there's like these just goofy moments, these dumb moments, like these disappointing moments. Yeah. It's to depict it accurately. I mean, I think the fact that you made the movie funny was a good way to keep it in reality in an odd way.
Oh man, thank you. Yeah, I mean with those experiences, you know, if you're not laughing, you'll end up crying. So,
as broke as I've ever been on tour, and this question is for both Jeff and Matt. Have either of you ever had to siphon gas?
I don't know if I've ever had to actually siphon it. I'm sure I've stolen it somehow. I don't know if I've ever siphoned it.
There is a scene in the movie where you guys, the band, either goes to siphon or does siphon gas.
That would be me. Yeah. I mean, that was great personally because gasoline is one of my favorite flavors. So I got No, actually, I've not had to siphon gas, but, you know, it does get pretty desperate. And actually, one of my favorite criticisms that I've seen, like, I can't read reviews because I'm just like, I can't torture myself like that. We've got a lot of positive response, but simply my favorite was somebody, they started it out, they said, "Now, I've never been in a band. And I've never been on tour, but let me tell you something. This is not how it works." And I was like, "All right, well, let's hear what this guy has to say." And I thought he was going to be like, you know, this is like where the bus is, where, and he was like, "If this is too fucking glamorous." I was like, "Glamorous?" I was like, "There's like sparks shooting out of our amplifiers, and like we're sleeping in the van. Like, what shows are you going to?" So yeah, that was my favorite, I think.
I feel like what really lent a level of authenticity to the film. So correct me if I'm wrong, but the band house, the van, and all the band gear, Jeff, that's all yours, right?
Yeah, that's all mine. Yeah. yeah. That piece of shit house. That's mine.
I mean, it looks like where I lived when I was touring all the time. And
yeah,
your van looks like a real band van.
Yeah, well, it was.
Yeah. But it was just like, I was watching it just being like, this feels way too real. Because I went into it completely blind, not knowing what the movie was going to be. And then when the band actually starts playing and you like lean into the amp and start feeding back, I was like, this is like a real band. This isn't like a Hollywood made up band. Like, they know too much.
That means a lot, man. That's really nice of you to say. Actually, the cool thing about that for me watching back is like, you know, my girlfriend and I bought our house, and that's what it looked like when we bought it. And we were like fixing it and living in here while we were fixing it. So like, you know, we're really roughing it at first, but Matt came when we were trying to figure out where the band lived, and he saw my house in that stage, and he's like, "This will do just fine."
Yeah.
And so, and it worked. I mean, it totally you know. And as was often the case with old vans, that van is no longer. So it's just cool. It's kind of rad to see a little time capsule of these things as they were, you know.
So there's a scene in the movie where the characters are hanging out and a couple of metalheads pull into the parking lot. Let's talk about that scene. Where did that idea come from? This whole idea of metalheads in a parking lot?
The band Slapstick. I mean, I grew up like loving on Slapstick, and that scene I had always kind of had in my head as a scene I wanted to do. I didn't know it would be like it would finally be realized through Uncle Peckerhead, but I kind of wanted a showdown between punks and metalheads in a parking lot. I definitely the inspiration came from that song, and I think it's like one of my favorite song titles. I was so surprised at how quickly, people once they watched the film kind of caught the reference. Cause I thought, you know, maybe a couple of people or maybe like friends of mine that knew that I was really into Slapstick growing up. That's all Slapstick.
I love that it's, these two metalheads, they screech into a parking lot. Then they get out of the car, they put on some metal, and then they just start drinking and raging. Like, that's what metalheads in a parking lot do.
Those guys were sick. I mean, Josh and Alex that played the metalheads are just fucking, they were incredible, dude. That might have been the last night we were filming.
Yeah.
And they just, I mean, they made morale shoot through the roof with that. That was just fucking great.
Yeah, because we had been, I mean, it really felt like a tour, the shooting of the movie, because we went, we shot for 3 weeks with Sundays off, so we shot for 18 days. And I mean, since we were a DIY operation, you are basically filling, like every person's filling, like, you know, at least a dozen roles, if not more. So by those last 2 days, everyone's energy is zapped, morale's like a little low. And I'm telling you, like when Josh and Alex showed up, and Josh is from a band, School Drugs, that I really love, and Alex is a really great comedian now living in Atlanta. But they like showed up ready for the part. I mean, when they pulled into the parking lot, I mean, they got out and they were just like slamming like Coca-Cola and like raging, and you could see everybody on crew was like, oh shit. And you could see like they kind of brought the energy up, because I mean they were literally headbanging probably for like 7 or 8 hours, like throughout the entire
night. And I don't think that they knew each other before that day, right?
No, they had no idea. And it's crazy because their chemistry, and they both had the same, I gave them a little direction. I showed them like, you know, a few videos I'd found on YouTube as far as like how I wanted them to kind of like the look and kind of the, how I wanted them to physically carry themselves and kind of the headbanging. But yeah, I mean, they were totally in sync, and I couldn't believe, I mean, I know Alex was like, I think he felt that maybe he had a concussion by the end of it.
So you mentioned School Drugs as one of the bands. Were there any other members of bands that filled out roles in the film?
Augusta, my friend Augusta of Kaitana and Gladdy fame, she did the singing voice of Judy for all the Duh songs in the movie.
Yeah.
So that was sick.
And Bill Orender, who recorded the drums for all the Duh songs, he was in Captain We're Sinking. He plays in Elway now, and he plays in Jeff's band, 500 Bucks. I'm trying to think, as far as I like, my brother is the dead body in the opening, and he is, I mean, he's been working in, like, he books shows. So he worked at House of Independence. He worked at the old Asbury Lanes way back in the day. So we've had people that, if they're not in bands, they've like worked in the music industry, or they've managed, or they've booked shows. But I'm trying to think, I don't think as far as actors, we had anybody else that was in any bands that.
Yeah. But we reached out to a lot of friends who like let us use, you know, cause we had to get permission to use like shirts. So like, the Menzingers and the Bouncing Souls and like
you get a Lemuria.
Yeah, Lemuria, Doll Baby. Yeah, but you know, anybody that like let us use their shit was really cool.
Yeah, we had Augusta on this podcast because she has ska roots.
Yeah.
And after we were done taping the episode, as we were just kind of downloading the files and stuff, I think Adam brought your movie up. And she's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, are you in a Kaitana video?
Oh, I probably. Yeah.
So I think I brought that up. And then she was like, oh, yeah, I actually am the voice of the female singer in Duh. And I was like, what? Like,
oh, yeah, I forgot I did this like fucking movie thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, she's great. I mean, actually, you know, Gus and I have been friends for a very long time. She's my neighbor now. She lives right down the street from me. She lives like a block away from me now. But no, we've been recording the Duh record together. So like we just had like a lot of positive feedback from this, and I just kind of took us by surprise, and so we just decided to record like a full length. Like, I mean, it's a fake band, you know.
But yeah,
we're Bill and I wrote these songs, and Augusta's gonna sing on the record. So that's pretty much all we have left to do. Is like we recorded all the music already, but we just got to get Gus's vocals down and mix and master it and send it off to get pressed.
Yeah, that's gonna be awesome. I mean, if monkeys can do it, why not you guys?
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, I wouldn't give myself that much credit. So, you know. Oh, you meant the band The Monkees. Oh, I get it.
You just thought actual monkeys.
It's like, I know I write fucking simple music, but Jesus, man, give me a break.
So we had Brandon and Rob from Slapstick on the show. And
yeah,
Adam brought up Uncle Peckerhead to them. It's like, have you seen this movie? Did you see that there's a reference to Metal in the Parking Lot? And they're like, what? Really? They'd never heard about it before.
That's so good.
So we got to break the news to them.
Yeah.
Thank God. Man. What did they think? How did they feel about it?
I mean, they seemed to be stoked. I mean, when I saw the movie, I mean, like I said, I went into it completely blind. I felt like I was being pranked for a second because there were so many things that like really like held like a place in my heart. And like, so then like when there's just like kind of the throwaway line about Metalhead in the Parking Lot, but then they like repeat it and then it gets repeated again. And then there's like a big title card. I started just looking around like, what's going on?
Hey, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm so glad that worked.
Yeah. I'm glad we dedicated an entire scene to that reference. That's great. That's like the best part.
How big of a Slapstick fan were you? Were they a big band for you back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of bands from like the Asian Man roster, I was a big fan of. I mean, I wouldn't say they were my favorite band, but they definitely were like a band that I consistently listened to in high school and college. And like I was in a ska band in high school.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of sounded like Slapstick, like that wave or that vein of kind of ska punk. And that kind of like more of kind of a grittier, like punky vocals. I think they were like a huge influence, especially when I was in my early days of like playing guitar and stuff like that. And I love that. I mean, that Asian Man release, which is like basically encapsulates their entire discography. So I would say, I still, every time they come on my Spotify, like playlist and stuff, I mean, I still know the lyrics. I love on that band.
Yeah, he doesn't skip it. He listens to it.
Wait, so what was your ska band called?
Oh man, you guys are going to beat me up.
no judgment here.
Rudy Can't Fail. It was a Clash. We were huge Clash fans too, but it was called Rudy Can't Fail.
That's hardly the worst band name I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad.
I mean, there was a restaurant in the East Bay for years. I think it owned by?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still there. Okay. Is it Green Day? Green Day guys?
Yeah, it's Mike Durant from Green Day has a restaurant called Rudy's Can't Fail Cafe.
So yeah.
So Jeff, you never had a ska band?
No, I didn't. I've had a lot of like ska band names like Jehovah and the Witnesses and like things like that, but I never played in a ska band. No, I played in a lot of mediocre bands. but
haven't we all?
Yeah, no sky.
I love the fake bands, fake band titles.
Oh yeah,
let's go through some of them. Here's the ones that
let's
Brainbuster, Acid Cat.
Yep.
My favorite is Turd Toilet.
Yes.
The one that was Marshmallow Dicks, was that a band or was that an artist? I can't
remember. That was an artist.
That was a good name, though.
He did our they did our EP artwork.
Ah.
Yeah, I mean, like, one thing I always do with my wife is we always come up with like what our fake band name should be. I probably have like a bunch of spiral notebooks of just kind of iterations on different types of bands. Like, if we were a thrash metal band, what would our name be? If we were a ska band, what would our name be? If we were, you know, if we were a classic rock band, what would our name be?
Do you have any of your ska band ones on the top of your head?
I don't. I know the last one that I told my wife is I wanted to be in like a thrashy punk band called JonBenet Shamsie. That was the last one.
That's solid. Yeah, you need to start that.
I'm working on it. I'm trying to get my wife to play drums for me.
We'll be right back after this.
So Matt, this movie, you had envisioned this movie years ago, right?
Yep.
And so as I understand it, you had the closing scene in mind and you were, you thought of, so Jeff's old band is Holy Hell.
Holy Mess.
Holy Mess. Sorry. And what's the name of the song? Trash Art? You were hearing Trash Age. Oh, I'm messing everything up. Okay. So you pictured Trash Age playing during the closing scene, as you pictured it now. That's kind of like the early roots of the movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, the early roots of the movie kind of came from, I had like an idea that I wanted to pitch to Adult Swim as like kind of a series, like a 15-minute episode, like episodes series about like kind of built around the 90s like sitcom, where it's like a bunch of like, you know, punk kids living in this kind of squatter house with, and inexplicably they're living with this kind of like tweaker older dude, and he kind of is there, like I always described it as a punk rock Full House with a redneck Mr. Belvedere. And I combined that with, I wanted to do a horror movie about like the trials and tribulations of a tour. So I kind of combined those two, but when I started the script writing phase, and I knew I wanted to work with Jeff because, Jeff and I had worked on a short film and I knew he was really like the first collaborator, that I kind of, enlisted to work on this with me. And I love the Holy Mess. I mean, all of Jeff's music, but I love the Holy Mess and Trash Age in particular. I think I think I've told Jeff this, like the lyrics, I think, were kind of perfect for the kind of like some of the themes I wanted to take on with Peckerhead. And it sounds crazy because it is like a shit and piss movie. But there's like a lyric in Trash Age that it's like, my little love, Jeff, I'm misquoting it. Just like yell at me. My little love, I'm not around. I've taken lost and I don't want to be found. There's what is it, Jeff?
I want to hear you do this. No, I'm just kidding. It's okay. There's a lot that's wrong in this world and me. There's a hole in my chest where my heart used to be.
Yeah. And I always thought that that's like such a great encapsulation of Peckerhead, of this idea of this like kind of wandering person, like this kind of like wanderer that's kind of searching for connection and searching for people. And that's kind of like one of the things I wanted to do with writing that character is, I don't consider him to be like the villain of the film. I think he definitely does like very heinous stuff, and he definitely is like the main conflict for Judy and the band. But I wanted to kind of create like what I love about like the old Universal monster movies or a lot of the horror movies I love, where, you know, the main antagonist or kind of the villain is actually like the sympathetic figure that you really kind of feel for, that he's probably, you know, this is out of his hands, that he has no control. And I felt like Trash Age, even though like Trash Age, that's not what it's about, at least, you know, in the entire like body of the lyrics, there were just, there's like a certain sentiment in that, in that song, and especially towards the end, that I think really kind of wraps up, you know, how I see the titular character of Peckerhead and how I see kind of some of the themes I wanted the film to take on. So Jeff was so nice in that, like, I know that, you know, it can sometimes be a drag to kind of rehash, you know, old stuff you've written, and you kind of, and Jeff had written like an amazing kind of collection of songs for Dud to perform, you know, throughout. But he was awesome that, you know, he re-recorded that song. And I think it's such like sonically, it's such kind of a beautiful end to the film, and it kind of matches the energy and the intensity and kind of the batshitness of what I wanted that end to kind of feel and embody.
So we're going to go ahead and make this like a full spoiler episode. Like, people need to watch the movie before they say this. So just, you can just say what happens at the end of the movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, so at the end of the movie, they're performing this song, and they've been out of jail. Peckerhead's still kind of on the loose, kind of, you know, just, you know, they don't know where he is. And I mean, what I wanted with the ending is I wanted it to be ambiguous, where you don't know if Judy now is just like doomed to always have to look over her shoulder and to always worry, like, what if Peckerhead's at the show? What if it's midnight? Is he following us? You know, does he have our band in his sights? Or if Peckerhead is really there and he is destroying the crowd in front of them, and perhaps just leaving the crowd dead and leaving them alive to kind of suffer the consequences of their actions, of their, you know, their deal with the devil. But I didn't want to make it, you know, too explicit. It leans a little bit more into that he's actually killing people with the soundtrack of the yells and the screams and the cries. But I still wanted it to be somewhat ambiguous, that you don't know if that's all in Judy's head. And now that's her fate. Her fate is that, you know, she sold her soul, and now she has to kind of look over her shoulder while she's touring and while she's enjoying this newfound fame.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of accomplishing that, because, like, just zooming in on just her expression and kind of her eyes, and you can kind of hear the screaming and whatever's going on, but it's done in a way where it could be imagined. It leaves you thinking at the end, and I feel like that makes it more powerful than actually showing anything.
Yeah, I kind of always imagine that it could just either be the crowd, yeah, like the crowd could either be like cheering or being torn to shreds, and yeah, kind of, you know, the viewer's left with that.
I would love to hear a little bit about the original kind of intent or meaning behind the song when you first wrote it, Jeff.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to pin down necessarily, but like, I think when I was writing that, I wrote that and another song for an EP that we did, that my old band did. And it was, we called the 7-inch Trash Age, but I kind of just had this like meandering theme of like, you know, humans have made it through, you know, the Ice Age and, you know, the Dark Ages, and now we have to endure the Trash Age, which is just sort of what we're living in now, with, like, you know, a climate change and pollution and just, you know, endless war and fucking, you know, civil, just complete, everybody wants to kill each other. So it was kind of, those songs were written around that kind of premise, and and so Trash Age just sort of translated into that. Matt really liked the song, and I actually wrote an acoustic record first that I did a different version of it on, and then the Holy Mess turned it into a song, and then we put it in the movie.
Nice. Yeah,
so yeah,
so there's an acoustic version, a Holy Mess version, and a Duh version.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yes, there's a few different iterations of the tune.
Next up, ska band version.
Exactly. Yeah, dude. Yeah, it's called I'm Horny. It's called I'm Horny for Trash Age.
What year did you write that song?
I think probably like 2016.
Okay.
Right around the time, you know, old DT was fucking getting in there and just taking a shit on everything.
Yeah.
So it was very bleak then. Little did I know it could get bleaker.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Much bleaker,
Are we more trash age now?
Yeah. We're pretty much just, you know, laying on the floor with our hangover all day and crying about everything.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. Yeah.
We're all Uncle Peckerhead.
Yeah, exactly. The other song, actually, it's funny because that song's called Trash Age. Like I said, I wrote like them as an EP. The other song's called Flesh of the Fresh, Blood of the Dove. And that song actually is just screaming the whole time, we're all going to die in the trash age. So, yeah, they're kind of interlinked. Actually, Matt and I did a video for that song. Matt directed that video, and I got tortured in it.
Okay, I want to ask about that video because you're wearing a Duh shirt in that video.
Yep.
So What's going on? When was that video shot? What was Duh at the time when you shot that video?
So Jeff had approached me about kind of collaborating on doing a video for that song. And we had finished production on a short film called Larry Gun Demon. And in Larry Gun Demon, it didn't end up making it into the final version of the script, but I imagined it's about a bunch of punk kids that live in this house and they have a demon for a roommate and they're trying to get, his rent so they can, they can pay the rent. And I always imagined that they were in a band together, like this group of punk kids, but that never really made it because we had to kind of shorten the narrative a little bit. But I had kind of, I had screen printed, or I had a friend screen print a bunch of like fake band t-shirts for them to wear. And in that movie, Jeff is wearing a Duh t-shirt. He's not playing the same character from Uncle Peckerhead. He's playing another character, but I imagine that like a band they would play with was called Duh. So we had like a bunch of Duh t-shirts. That I wanted to kind of like pepper throughout things that we were shooting, whether it be like music videos or web videos or, especially that short film. And when it came to writing Peckerhead, when I was thinking of the band's name, I wanted something that was really like could roll off the tongue, was like one syllable, very easy, because they would be saying it a lot throughout in the dialogue. So I had a bunch of these screen printed t-shirts already. And I know there was a band, kind of like a superstar group called Duh, but it didn't seem like they were on a lot of people's radar. So I felt there wouldn't be any confusion as to whether, this was a fictional band or if we were kind of riffing on a band that existed. But yeah, the band Duh just came from these t-shirts I had printed for a short film.
Uh-huh. So tell me a little bit about the evolution of the film as it is now alongside the music and, the evolution of Duh as a band itself. You kind of talked about, your initial cart, kind of sitcom-y version of it. And then that turned into the movie and you started writing it. So as you're writing this movie, were you getting more and more involved with like creating a very realistic band with music?
Yeah, I mean, so once I started writing the script, I immediately reached out to Jeff, and I knew that I wanted Duh to feel like a real band. I wanted them to play original songs for the most part, and I knew Jeff was like the person to do that, just because I love Jeff's songwriting. I love his lyrical sensibilities and all that stuff. So, I mean, I gave Jeff very little direction as far as like we knew we wanted them to be a three-piece punk band. So obviously in terms of like the instrumentation that was kind of already kind of baked in. But I think the only thing that I really told Jeff as far as like the feel of the band was like joyously nihilistic, which I mean is kind of, I think, like what I love about Jeff, that's kind of like his sweet spot. But then Jeff just started, I mean, Jeff, you, I'm sure, can talk about like the writing of that, of the Duh discography. But that was all Jeff.
Yeah. Let's hear about, what was your thought process in writing these songs, Jeff?
It was filtered through me. So I guess it's just, there's going to be like a little bit of me in there, but I guess Matt and I never really discussed like, this is what we want the band to sound like. You know, we didn't have any real, like, this is what it should sound like. And now, like, kind of in hindsight, like, I think also I was just going through such a crazy time in my personal life at that particular moment. Like, looking back at it, I'm like, man, I should have, like, thought about that more. You know, I was like, it's kind of crazy how, and I don't want to make it sound like it was completely thoughtless, but, like, as far as, like, the direction of it, like, you know, and it was kind of fun and interesting for me, too, because I had never written with, like, you know, Matt gave me the script and I was reading along of, like, what's happening in these scenes, like, what's happening. And so, like, when I was trying to write some of these songs, I, like, thematically was kind of like, you know, taking references from that, which I'd never done before. It was like, that was actually, like, really, really fun and interesting. But to go along with the hopelessly nihilistic, whatever, aspects of it, I was getting fucked by my landlord, not physically, but, you know, metaphorically. And it was like, like that house that you see in the movie, we had got that and like all kinds of fucking shit was going wrong with it. My girlfriend and I were like, you know, essentially in between places. So it was like, we were almost like homeless and like just on the verge of like a nervous breakdown every day. And I would come and like try and save my house from like, you know, from losing my house and like work on it all day. And literally like at night, I would just be like, all right, I have to drink 6 beers and write these songs for this movie. So it kind of like lent itself naturally to just being desperate, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just like a weird time in my life, but it, you know, it worked out.
Did you work out the songs with other musicians? Because they're very band-oriented type songs with chemistry and all this other stuff.
Well, I pretty much just wrote them all. And then my buddy Bill, who played the drums, who's also in my band, my real band, 500 Bucks, you know, he's just like one of the best drummers, and he's a great songwriter himself. But like, I kind of wrote a lot of these just like, you know, as we were hopping from like Airbnb to Airbnb, kind of in the process of this whole, you know, whatever. And yeah, I would just go to him with the songs and we kind of like knock them out, and I'd send Matt ideas and things like that. And it all kind of just came together very like quickly and fluidly. And yeah, but he was an instrumental part in that process. So
how was it getting the other actors to like mime perform those songs? Like, cause everybody looks like they're actually playing. It looks great.
Dude, they were great. Chet and Ruby, who played Mel and Judy, they were just fucking, they're great actresses. And, yeah, I mean, we did it. I recorded Bill playing the songs on drums and sent that to Ruby. And I played the songs on bass and sent it to Chet. And they really just studied the iPhone videos we made for the most part. I mean, yeah.
So, and it's, and like, I mean, that means a lot to hear musicians, people that actually play, say that. And I'm sure Ruby and Chad would really appreciate it. But I mean, beyond like Jeff said, like he recorded Bill and then we recorded Jeff and sent them videos, but also we paid for like, and again, it wasn't a lot, like 3 or 4 lessons, especially Ruby. I think Chet had a friend that played bass that kind of like showed her kind of like physically how to hold it. And kind of like, she just basically watched Jeff play in these videos and kind of mimed that. But Ruby actually took, I think like at least like 4 lessons and just kind of like, played to those songs with her instructor. But what's great is that, you know, the first day that we were set to kind of do one of the performances, which is their first performance on the road. I know that like, especially Ruby, but both Chet and Ruby were really kind of like spooked, cause they had never done it and both of them, like, I don't think they definitely didn't play their respective instrument, but I don't think they have any experience playing an instrument at all. And I mean, within the first take of that, the performance at the club, when like the amps are sparking, like they were locked in, and it was like also one of the first times that it really felt like we kind of understood what the movie was, and we kind of captured like the energy we really wanted the movie to kind of have. So it's really, I mean, I'm incredibly impressed, because one of the things that I always hate in movies is where it's so clear that the person doesn't even know what a fucking guitar is, and they're just kind of like slapping it, and that always irked me. So like one of the things, even though we didn't have a lot of money, is we really wanted them, and they were totally committed to do so, to, you know, really try, even though we couldn't, you know, have them actually perform it live, to really actually look and like actually have some experience with their instrument. So it doesn't look like, you know, some cheesy Hollywood kind of, you know, band.
Yeah. I mean, I play drums, and I'm very surprised to hear that Ruby didn't have prior experience before, because she looks like a drummer. Like she looks
she
like
killed she it. Yeah. Her.
Yeah. Yeah. She does it, great.
And I think too, like to kind of touch on what Matt was saying, that first day, the first song that's in the movie, that was like our first time all of us like on stage together and like doing this. And I do remember that, you know, Ruby and Chet were pretty nervous, like, in the beginning. And again, this just kind of lends itself to like the whole vibe of the movie, and like, you know, just what helped us build the chemistry, how, you know, it really, there were so many moments where it felt like we really were a band. And just sort of right before we were like started filming, we kind of literally had like a huddle on stage, and, you know, we're just like, I was just like, hey, look, this is like punk music. You don't have to be good at it. Just have fun. Like, I fuck up at shows all the time and I have a good time, you know? And I was just like, it doesn't matter. Like, don't even like, just have a good time. That's all that fucking counts. And we, you know, we did a take, and it was like, it just felt good from the start. And the more we did it, the more just natural and fun it felt. And I think it was just like this really rad cathartic thing. 'Cause after that set the tone for the rest of, you know, the rest of the shoot, because I think that was day two maybe. And that, and again, I kind of built confidence in the crew, and definitely the rest of the cast, that like, oh, okay, cool. This is like, we could be a real band here, you know?
Just to circle back with like Jeff's music, like, especially, you know, being able to kind of convince people that like, not just the music, but the movie's real, is when Jeff was demoing the Dust songs and kind of sending me it, once we kind of were locked in, and we kind of knew, like, I think Jeff had sent me Too High to Cry and I Wanna Die Young. That was like a tool that we used to kind of enlist people to help with the movie. Because besides the script, and like we had a lookbook, we didn't really have a lot of resources, or we couldn't really produce a lot of resources, because we really didn't have any money, you know, at any point, especially in pre-production in the early stages. So one of like the great things is like, you know, when you're asking somebody, you know, to take, you know, 'cause, you know, people on like a union shoot would, you know, charge you, you know, X amount of dollars, you know, for their day rate. And you're trying to convince like a buddy, or you're trying to convince like, you know, like some people in the crew to kind of work for, you know, this kind of indie rate. When you're able to kind of play them the music, and it's like incredibly catchy, and it sounds like a real band, and it sounds like kind of fully realized, I feel that like a bunch of people that ended up helping out, whether it was like as crew or just somebody that's doing us a favor, like letting us shoot somewhere, to be able to kind of use that as kind of something to prove that we're a real, like a real deal operation, and the music's really going to be good. I think it gave people, it kind of gave people confidence in us, or it made it seem like we weren't just a bunch of kids that just kind of wanted to grab a camcorder and make a movie.
Yeah. I think one thing that was like really impressive too, was that, so Augusta did the vocals for Judy.
Yeah.
But it totally matches. Was that a happy accident? Was that a happy accident, or in casting, did you consider that the actress needed to look like she would have Augusta's voice?
It, I mean, just a happy accident. For real. I couldn't get over, because Chet like would, because in order to like really sell those moments too, like they're really playing and they're really singing. And it's crazy because obviously, you know, Gus has like an incredible voice. But when Chet would kind of sing the part, she was kind of in the same range as Gus. So like, yeah. it did make sense too. Like, I think Chet's singing or Chet's screaming voice kind of like matched Gus's in terms of like the range. Like, I think they're both probably in like around the same spot. So that was just, I mean, just pure luck, just thankful.
Yeah. That's something that you talk about, like what Hollywood makes films. That's something that always sticks out to me. Like, the singing voice does not match the speaking voice.
Yeah.
And you're like, come on.
Yeah.
Dude. Brutal.
Yeah.
yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
I like, because, I mean, Adam already said this, that, you know, you guys sound like a real band and everything. Like the only other movie on the top of my head that I can think of where I like the music as a band separate from the movie is Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
And I remember watching that movie like behind the scenes, because I've watched that movie a bunch of times and listened to the music. I watched behind the scenes and there's like footage of the main guy who wrote all the music, and they just had like such dumb band conversations, you know, like, oh, let's put a little George Harrison-y part here. I'm like, that's why this sounds good. They have all those dumb band conversations. And that's what, you know, that's what they don't do in Hollywood movies. They don't think like band people, which is like really dissecting the parts and like all your like thoughts about the parts and like really taking the time. But like this project came mostly from your head, Jeff, the music part. But were you bouncing ideas off of like the people you were playing with and really trying to do that band thing to make them really come alive?
To be honest, it just sounds so ignorant. I wish I did. That's why I said like more where I was just like, man, that was sort of like, not that it was like not thoughtful, because I definitely did put thought into it. I just... like, we were just so pressed for time, and like I said, I just was, man, it was one of the most stressful times of my life anyway, outside of this. So I would get home from like the worst day of my life every day and sit down in a place that wasn't mine, like in a fucking corner while my girlfriend is trying to sleep, and like, all right, like just fucking sit and like write songs about, you know, my terrible life. and it worked. And I mean, and like I said, I mean, I played the guitar, the bass, and Bill played the drums. So we would get together like maybe once a week or every other week. And I'd be like, all right, like, here's what I got. And then Bill and I would sit with the songs. But I think that just also lends itself. Bill is just such a fucking good drummer and songwriter that like, I don't know. It's a truly a joy to play with them, because there's some weird thing that happens when we get together. We'll get in a room and show him something, and he will just fucking play it. Just, you're like, yep, that's what I was thinking. You know, like, goddamn, Bill. You know, great job.
Having no knowledge of how films are made, I bet you like the problem is that most movies are like, okay, this is a punk band, so we need to. What are the punk bands going to sound like?
Whereas, we need more blue hair on track three.
Yeah. But like, you know, none of these people making movie would be like, okay, let's get this guy whose life is falling apart and just soundtrack his life erupting in chaos. And that'll be the band.
Yeah. I mean,
like that would never happen.
Yeah. How sustainable does that sound on paper? You know, fucking Jesus Christ. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for trusting me.
But that's why it sounds like a real band.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but yeah, I mean, you know, and that just, it just came together, I guess, you know, very naturally, as it were. And again, we were all in a time crunch, and everybody was wearing a million different hats. So nobody, I don't think Matt or I were like, no, man, that third song, it could use a little more safety pin, you know, like fucking, I would send Matt a demo and I'm like, fuck, he's going to hate it. And he'd be like, I fucking love this one. I'm like, you do?
And Jeff's great with, I don't think Jeff gives himself enough credit because Jeff did such a good job of, like I said, I didn't really give him a lot of notes, but he had access to the script. So I would just say, song number two is played. But Jeff would obviously have the script read and would know, contextually, what's going on in these, right, in these moments. And I felt that I felt a lot of the songs that he wrote for those different, song two, song three, that it kind of matched what I wanted, the band to kind of sound like in these moments. Cause I don't think all the songs kind of sound, I know no one's saying it, but none of the songs really sound the same. It sounds like organically from, the same three people. Jeff did such a great job of understanding, the scenes that these songs are kind of appearing in and kind of context of what's come before, and how that kind of influences, each and every song that he wrote. So I think he did such a great job, even if it was kind of an unconscious thing.
Well, I think that, and I think that really helped. Like I was kind of getting at earlier is that, I'd never written with, I don't know if direction's the right word, but having a context of a script and it would be song two plays, whatever. But having an idea of what these characters are going through and then sort of being able to write from their perspective, but then also filter that through, distill it, that's how you get a song like I Want to Die Young. It's thematically has sort of touchstones of what's going on in this movie, but then at the same time are just like, somebody fucking kill me. Get this over with. Jesus Christ. Every day I look at my alarm clock and say, oh, fuck, another one.
I want to ask about Dominion Rising. This is the band in the film.
Mm-hmm. First off, I'd like to just say thank you for not making them a ska band.
Hell yeah. We wouldn't do that.
Yeah, thanks for not doing us dirty like that.
Yeah, we ain't gonna do you guys dirty like that. Don't worry.
So this character's introduced before we hear his band, and it's clear that he's a total self-important douche. Then once we down the road get to hear his music, perfect. It's he's just speaking important sounding words that have no meaning, and occasionally screaming words randomly. I want to hear if there is an inspiration behind A, the band themselves, and B, the character.
Yeah, I mean, so growing up, in the late 90s and early aughts, I kind of wanted the band to kind of feel like one of those haircut bands from that era. Mm-hmm. And really, in terms of that character, the guy who plays Shiloh, who's the lead singer of Dominion Rising, it's like one of my best friends, Ryan Conrath, who is also our line producer. Again, people wearing dozens of different hats. This guy's making sure we have our lunch on time, but is also playing this insufferable prick. And so he and I went to grad school together in Boston, and we used to do these web videos, and one of the characters he would do was kind of this pretentious philosopher. And it was just we were just kind of making fun of, we were in academia and we were just so many people were so insufferable and thought every single fucking thing they said was so important and groundbreaking. So I basically no joke, I was like, I want you to kind of harness that character that you did a decade ago. And then I sent him interviews of Jared Leto from 30 Seconds to Mars. I was just I'm telling you, I was trying to find the right lead singer rock star to send him. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen these interviews with Jared Leto. I mean, you could literally probably just type in 30 Seconds to Mars interview and you will not be disappointed. They are just it's like Shiloh. Shiloh is basically just a little bit more of a steroided up version of Jared Leto when he does his 30 Seconds to Mars interviews. And then musically, again, this is just very little direction, just kind of threw it at Jeff. But that's one we collaborated on because I wrote the lyrics. But then Jeff, wrote the music and sang the backup vocals.
Yeah. What does that say about both of us?
Well, what were you thinking when you wrote the Dominion Rising music? What was your thought process, or like, I'm going to try to give it a little bit of a this quality?
Well, you know what? It's always good to know you can write a really bad song. most people try to write good ones, but I try to see if I can write a really bad one. Actually, you know who helped me crack the code on that was, like, it was funny because originally we were like gonna outsource that. We're just sort of like, I don't fucking know. And Matt was like, you want to take a swing at it? Like, you want to try? I'm like, fuck it. We're already like doing this. So like, let's try to write this song. And really, I was just like, well, how do we write just like a really like butt rock, like shitty, you know, whatever. And Bill fucking, you know, Bill Orender cracked the code. He was like, you know, he showed me this band I never heard before called Breaking Benjamin. And he's like, dude, he's like, you have to listen to them. And I was like, all right. And we were like watching all these YouTube videos. And we were watching, like, we were just like watching bands like that. And like, dude, Bill was like, you know what it is, man? He's like, it's like, if you listen to the music, he's like, it's not as bad as you think it is. He's like, it's just like shitty watered down rock music. And he's like, but once the haircut grabs the microphone, it all goes downhill. And we were like, that's it. That's the formula. So that was, you know, we were just trying to, you know, I don't know. And then Matt, you know, Matt came over to my house and we recorded the words. Oh, my God. Yeah. So collab of the century.
There was that era of music where, like, lyrically you had to cite, like, suicide, a blackbird, and, like, just, like, a bunch. Like, it was kind of like a Mad Libs. But you had to have, like, you know, at least, like, you had, like, your bingo sheet where you had to have, like, four or five of these, like, references or, like, you know, these nouns or adjectives. So I just kind of, like, went through, you know, like, lyrically.
There's got to be a crow. They got you have to say tonight or sky, you know.
Yeah,
there's got to be. Yeah.
The best is the parts where he just screams like one word, that's the real meaning right there.
Yeah, that's it. I think he's literally screaming cry.
Yeah,
the word cry. So there you go.
That bit right there, and then just showing that he's not wearing any shoes.
Yeah. I forgot he's barefoot, dude.
And he has a carpet that he performs.
Yeah. Oh man.
Brings his carpet to stomp around on.
That was all. That's like Ryan's idea. Is I wanted him to be barefoot, and he's like, "Well, what if I just bring my own carpet?"
It's incredible.
That's so good because you can picture that person existing in a band.
I've fully seen that band play.
But that's what I'm saying. That to me, I feel like that's what so many people are like, I know that guy. You know, they're like, I know that band. I've like any band that I'm friends with has just been, yeah, like if you've been doing it for a while, you're like, yeah, we fucking played with that band before. We met them. Met them in 2005.
You brought up a few issues in the movie that I would like to discuss. First issue, is it okay to wear your own band shirt?
I would say no, but
okay.
You know what? I mean, I did it in the movie. Maybe it's time to bring it back. That's it. I feel like bands used to do that a long time ago, you know?
Matt, what do you think?
I mean, so it's kind of like if a tree falls in the woods, because I am only wearing Doug gear when I'm in my house. Like, I wear stuff from the movie, like Uncle Peckerhead t-shirts and Doug t-shirts. But I am reluctant to go out, especially if I know I'm going to see friends. If I'm just, like, walking my dog around or just kind of grabbing a coffee, I don't mind it. But if I'm going to see friends, I don't know if I don't wear it because I know I'm going to catch shit from my friends. Or if I do think it's like a social faux pas. I don't know. I think it's like one of those things where it's like, if it brings you joy, just do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude, there's no such thing as guilty pleasures in this life, only pleasures. Do whatever the fuck makes you happy.
Yeah, and I love Max so much that I almost want to kind of defend him and his choices. So I'd say I would give an emphatic yes. I've decided...
Yeah, I changed my answer to yes as well.
Adam, you wear your own shirt all the time. Let's hear your case.
I feel like from a touring band perspective, it fully makes sense to wear your own band's shirt, because maybe you don't have a clean shirt anymore.
You're telling everybody who you are.
And you can also just like, oh, I'll just grab one of these and put it on.
Dude, I feel like we're also making the argument for smelling your own farts. There's nothing like your own brand, you know? What do we think about bands that say their own names in their own songs? Now that is truly...
Well, I like that.
I like that too.
It's like a rapper move.
When the Hold Steady does it, I fucking like it.
Yeah, but you know what? I actually hate in movies when the title of the movie is said... the movie. I'm with you guys on band.
Yeah. Can you imagine Metallica fucking just saying Metallica while they're playing?
They fully do.
What? No, they don't.
In Whiplash, I swear to God they do. They say because we're Metallica.
Oh my God. Whiplash.
All right. Well, there you go. That fucking answers it. I changed my answer on that too. I don't like when bands do that. Except for the Hold Steady, maybe. I'll give them a pass.
All right, next issue. The idea of good and bad banter on stage is kind of comes up frequently.
Yeah.
What is the epitome of bad stage banter? What is it that
saying your own name in the song? Saying your own name in the banter. Just like after the song's over, you just go Metallica.
One thing I really don't like, this isn't like the be all end all, because I am very kind of critical of onstage banter. I like in the last band I was in that toured, our singer, who was like such a lovely person, still friendly with him, but he had the worst fucking banter ever. Like really, really, really kind of cringy banter. But one thing that I don't like that bands do is when they're just talking to each other, like kind of just like as if they're just kind of like hanging out during a practice and like don't kind of engage and don't kind of like, not that you have to like do like, you know, a tight 15 of your best stand up or whatever. But just kind of like, they're just kind of looking at each other and just kind of like kind of talking under their breath and like just referencing stuff that happened that day. And very inside jokey. That's something that just I hate, that drives me nuts.
Were you driven? Because obviously you brought it up in the movie several times, and you made it like a point to show that that was part of Max's journey as a character, to go from having no idea how to do it to like reading off of his hand a halfway decent banter. Was that something that, you know, you had thought about a lot before you wrote the movie, or as you were writing the movie as a band person?
Yeah, I mean, so with that, it was like narratively, I wanted to give, like, Judy has her arc. I don't think Mel needed an arc just because of her, like, her character, but I wanted to give, like, Max a little, like, just like a little arc where, like, you know, he overcomes something. And, you know, I was kind of like I wanted it to be band centric. I wanted it to kind of involve Judy to kind of have a hand in kind of like looking out for him as like an older sister type. And I was just trying to think of something innocent where like it doesn't really like make his character, it doesn't like it's not a bad look for his character. It can almost endear him to the audience. And I thought like just him not being able to like, you know, to speak in front of people, like to have like public speaking issues kind of made him like really endeared him to the audience even more. And it was something that I think I felt that could be, you could kind of have a simple kind of fix to it without like spending a ton of time, like giving like a ton more kind of the runtime or the screen time to that kind of like that conflict or that issue. So that was just kind of, I think, born out of like just kind of narratively just trying to find something that was like band centric and endeared Jeff to the audience or his character to the audience.
I see. Yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
I think it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about the venues that you played. I'm curious if you want to talk about any of them, if there are any specific places they are and or inspiration behind them.
Yeah, I mean, so the venues, I knew I wanted to do a punk basement. I knew I wanted to do like a VFW hall. I was just thinking of like places that some of my favorite show going memories And I didn't want to do like typical, I mean, like there is kind of the typical venue of House of Independence, which that was just because my brother was working there at the time. And like, I wanted that to kind of like visually have kind of a juxtaposition of like making it or like kind of succeeding in, you know, however Judy's framing it in her head. But that was like all the venues we found, it was like luck and just like friends of ours that were connected to those venues in some way. Like my friend Joey Marin, like lived in that house, at the end with the punk house where they perform. And it's this place called the Sound Hole, or it was called the Sound Hole. It's since, expired. But it was just like this Philly DIY venue just run by the kids that live in the house. And they would do, I mean, like any type of show, like everything from like EDM to like, you know, crust punk to, you know, whatever they would kind of like art installations they would do and shit. And the VFW hall was like, it's the brick VFW. So like, I mean, I've seen like Kid Dynamite there, like back in the day. So like that was kind of like a storied kind of venue, like around where I grew up in New Jersey. And my uncle just worked for the township and knew the guy that the head of the VFW there and just kind of called in a favor. And the shitty bar that they, for the first show that they had that kind of, like horrific experience was just kind of like, it's a fucking sports bar on the Jersey Shore, that has like, you know, like a Jimmy Buffett cover band, like plays there every weekend.
Jimmy Buffett. Yeah. Jimmy Buffett.
And that was like, again, like my brother just like knew the guy that booked there and was just like, hey, my brother's making this movie. Is there any way like they could shoot there on like a weekday, like in the morning and like for, you know, like just a couple $100? Yeah, so it was just kind of like calling upon, like trying to kind of like, if not the literal venue, trying to kind of like conjure up the feelings of the venues that I loved or the types of venues I loved growing up. And then just like calling in favors from people we know that either were associated with that venue or could, you know, could hook us up.
Setting up this movie really sounds a lot like just setting up a DIY tour.
Dude, I'm telling you.
Pretty much. I mean, seriously, dude, it was.
And we were shooting in Brooklyn. We were shooting all around New Jersey and in Philadelphia. So, and we had like a really small crew. So when we would do company moves to like, you know, shoot at a different location, it felt like we were on tour because we didn't have like one centralized location where most of the film and the action takes place. So like, Jeff was really driving the van with David, who played Peck, and Ruby and Chet. Of Duh fame. And I mean, they were like eating their meals together. And I mean, the whole crew was just kind of traveling from place to place, but the actual, like the core four in the movie, did all of their traveling. And they, I mean, Jeff and David, like, you know, roomed together, yeah. Me and Chet roomed.
The picture car was my car. And so, yeah. And so yeah, it truly by like day three, and onward was like a band on tour. We said it like every fucking day because also we all got along really well. We loved each other and became really good friends. And, you know, like I'm fucking playing punk music for these people that became my friends. And, you know, because some of them weren't really that well versed in it. And so I was like, oh, this is a band from Philadelphia in 2000. You know, they haven't been a band since 2011 or, you know, whatever. And like, it was just cool. It was bonding. And we had a really good time doing that. But I mean, that really lent itself to us feeling like a real band. We stunk. We fucking were traveling around in an old prison van, you know? So that was that.
Was that part of the authenticity element was to not shower?
I mean, we tried to shower. Yeah, I'd say we definitely... You know, just like in real life, you try to shower. It's not that you don't want to. So, yeah, I would say the desperation for looking for a shower is truly, that was authentic.
Yeah.
But no, we got showers. We got showers.
How was it cleaning up after some of the like gory scenes?
Oh, terrible. We almost ruined relationships over it forever.
Yeah. So when the Dominion Rising scene and the shitty promoter scene were both shot in the same apartment in Brooklyn. And it was my now wife, girlfriend at the time, sister. So it's my sister-in-law, let us shoot there. And again, this is like a small two-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn on the third floor. And like, I think there was some just some issues in terms of like with our a couple of our producers like really didn't do their job that day, and we shot both those scenes kind of back to back over the course of 2 days. And at one point I was like, do we have a cleaning crew to kind of take care of this, because the walls are drenched in blood. And they're like, yeah, they're going to come tomorrow. And I guess no one called the cleaning crew. So what happened was, Jeff, like on our day off, Jeff, Ryan, who played Shiloh, myself and my wife just like tried to clean the walls as best we can, but they were still like fucked up. So immediately following once we wrapped the film, so we wrapped the film on a Saturday night, I think Sunday afternoon, I went to my sister-in-law's place because she freaked out, as she should. She freaked out being like, I can't live here, you know, like blah, 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 blah. So I basically, not being a very, we had to refinish the bedrooms. Like we had to not just clean the walls, but I mean, like the trim was like so fucked. So basically for a week, I had to like do deep cleaning. And then, I worked with somebody on Thumbtack that I had hired to like help me to kind of like, you know, do the fixes of the walls and the trim and all that stuff. So it was.
Yeah. And that was our one day off too, the next day after doing that. And, you know, we were all so fucking tired that everybody were like, you guys get rest. Me, Matt, and his wife spent the whole, we just got hammered that night and spent that night and the whole next day cleaning the apartment to no avail while his sister-in-law cried somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really bad.
Yeah. And then like, didn't your cousin like never speak to you again?
Yeah. So when they go to Piss Face, the Piss Face headquarters with Nick, that was my cousin's house. And what's the craziest thing about that is, so I had said like, can we use your house to film? And I probably just didn't give him an idea of what it's like to have a film crew like come into a space. And what's crazy is, so we shot this scene in a bathroom where we like, you know, the camera crew kind of took the, like a mirror off of like the wall and did all this stuff. And my cousin came in as we were kind of doing this and like flipped out and kind of like read me the rights outside and was just like do it today, like finish today and then just get the fuck out of here. And what's crazy is we ended up cutting out the scene that like gave him the most agita and like caused the most stress. Like one of the days that caused the most stress, we ended up cutting that scene just because it didn't work. But yeah, he's such a lovely dude, but yeah, we didn't talk, or he wouldn't talk to me for a few months afterward. He was kind of holding on to a grudge, but we're good.
What was in
it? It was like a dream sequence scene where, so this is actually, I don't think I've ever told anybody outside of the crew. Nobody knows about this. So there's a scene when she's at Nick's house. So they go to Nick's house and basically what happens is like he shows them into the bedroom. And then in the movie, the next scene is they go immediately to the pool. There's a scene between those two scenes that we shot. And we even like did some like minor VFX work where she's in the bathroom. Judy's in the bathroom and she looks out the window and she sees Nick and Peck kind of hitting it off, like having a smoke and kind of like laughing. And then she goes into the shower and there's this dream sequence in the shower where Nick's standing across from her and they start to kiss. And there's like this weird kind of swirling kind of colors and stuff. And then when she pulls out, it's Peckerhead, and Peckerhead like does like a little kissy face. And then she like wakes up and like falls out of the shower. And the scene wasn't bad. I think it worked and it kind of had some like cool visual stuff. But I didn't like in terms of like the narrative that like it kind of confused that like, is she attracted to Peck or like, do they have, I didn't want there to be any confusion as far as like their chemistry. So I ended up cutting that out.
I see. Wow.
Jeff, just a little side thing. I love the little, hey, look at me when you jump in the pool thing that you do.
Oh, yeah,
so good.
Just vying for Nick's attention. Yeah.
Yeah. That was amazing. That cracked me up so hard.
Thank you. That was, you know, that was method acting at its finest. but no, that was, yeah, that was, you know, I don't know. The pitfalls of DIY filmmaking. I don't think Matt's cousin was familiar with DIY punk rock music. he was doing that thing where you punch the palm of your hands intimidatingly.
So Matt, I mean, and Jeff, you can answer too if this, if you have thoughts on this, but you made this movie based off of a touring band because, you know, this was a life that you had lived before, you know, being on the road doing these kind of shows. And you were kind of modeling these shows after ones that you had experienced before. Did you have any particular shows like that you remember that kind of were burned into your brain, you know, from this, from your back in the day of being in a DIY touring band?
Yeah, I mean, like not great in terms of the storytelling sense, but I mean, like I definitely played a show and the guy gave us $2. And I always feel with something like that, I don't mind not getting paid if you didn't make any money, but it's like I almost feel like it's a bit of an insult to just get like $2. And the guys, like, I've definitely gotten like just like a buck or $2 to play a show, not even splitting it, just the guy hands us like a single dollar bill. I've definitely like nightmarish stuff where, you know, you're in like, you know, Tampa Bay and your van's parked in like the back alley and, you know, somebody locks the keys in the trailer or, you know, like just something like that. And it's like, there's no like, you know, 24-hour locksmith that'll like come out at that point of the night. So you're just kind of like wandering kind of like the streets of Tampa at like, you know, 2 or 3 a.m. like trying to figure like are you going to even make the show the next day? I mean, just stuff like that where it's like, man, like I can't believe that didn't completely like crush us, you know, or like completely like destroy our spirit. But no, like none, no, I mean, you encounter like a ton of just like characters and just like total like weirdos and insane people. But I can't, Jeff, can you think of any really great?
I was trying to think of it.
I don't mean great necessarily, just vivid.
No, I mean? No, they wouldn't be great, but no, I don't know, man. It's just like kind of like a blur of all, especially like, you know, when I was young, really younger and playing in bands in high school and stuff. I mean, that was like truly the salad days of just like everything going wrong and just, but like, yeah, kind of like Matt said, you're just like, why did I keep doing it? Like, I must have really, I still play music. It's like, man, I must really like it to, you know, to go through that kind of stuff a lot, you know. But yeah, I don't know. When I'm on the spot right now, it's like kind of really hard to think of one particular moment. But, you know, yeah, there's been a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's crazy. Like, and again, maybe it's just because I can be incredibly cynical and I'm definitely like glass half empty a lot of the times when I like, when I reflect or frame things, which is probably not good. But I think there's like a lot of like, the music world and the film world kind of mirror each other. Cause I feel like back when I was in bands and like even now as a filmmaker, just in terms of like the grit you need to do it, but just how it does feel like when I'm kind of assessing it, like 98% of it is failure or at least like heavy compromise. And it's like you only do it because you really want to do it. Because like I've told Jeff this, but one of the most like kind of like mind blowing things that I had ever heard, and it kind of like unlocked why I do it is, you know, I've been making films for a couple of years, and it's kind of like, it's thankless and it's really tough. And, you know, it's just like, you're plugging away and you're like, you know, why at times, like, you're just questioning everything. Why am I doing this? And I went to this this screening event with Jeff Garland from Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's like a comedian. And it was like, it was students at the school I was going to. And he basically just hung out for 2 hours with like this group of students, like, you know, like just like a couple dozen of us, and was just shooting the shit, kind of like talking about, you know, like the industry. And this kid asked him, like, you know, like this kind of like really, you know, broad question of how do you make it? And he's like, I should say, like, he's really nice as he's saying this. It sounds like mean, but I kind of really understand the sentiment now. And he's like, how do you make it? He's like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, like, I want to be a writer director. How do I make it? And like Jeff Garland thinks for a minute and he's like, well, do you have like a backup plan? Like, what if it doesn't work out? What if you can't, what if you don't make a living being a writing director? Like, do you have a backup plan? And he's like, yeah, I mean, I could go, and again, I forget what the kid actually said, but it was something like, I could go work for my dad's insurance agency or whatever. And he's like, okay, well, like, you're probably going to do that. And he's like, you know, I worked in Chicago theater for like, you know, 25 years before I had any real big break. Like, I had to, you know, supplement my income by like waiting tables and doing this. And he's like, you know, most people, like, once they encounter any, like, if they don't encounter success in the first couple of years, they just go on and do something else. And he's like, I can't imagine doing anything else. He's like, all I want to do is like act and write and like collaborate in this world. And that kind of like felt, I mean, that kind of like to Jeff's point and the kind of how I feel about like filmmaking is, you know, I've definitely made a ton of films. Like, my first feature film was a total, I shouldn't say disaster. I mean, I'm still proud of it, but it did not succeed in the ways in which I thought. And that like bankrupted me, like, you know, like in every way, emotionally, you know, financially,
morally,
everything. Yeah. And you know, like the next year I was like, I want to make another movie. I learned a shit ton, and I know I can make something better. So I think both with like DIY music and film, they kind of have this thing where it's like, it sounds so kind of corny, but you know, the people that stick around are not really concerned with, you know, making bank or like, you know, fame or whatever. It's because like, that's the fucking only thing they can imagine themselves doing.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the show wherever you normally download podcasts. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's at In Defense of Ska. You can also sign up for my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get the podcast sent directly to your inbox every Wednesday. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has a great band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram. It's simply @Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And on that note, we leave you by saying, Ska now more than ever. Thank you.